study of the angel of the Lord. I promised you we would take questions this morning. We ran over a little bit. Did any of you, I had a couple of questions that I will repeat for you in a minute, but did any of you have questions that you wanted to ask? Now, the handout this morning is kind of a review of the angel of the Lord. I taught a whole course on that at one time in the past, but so this handout that I gave you is kind of a review of what we went over last week, plus some additional material. Did any of you, you understand the principle that we're talking about here, and that is that the angel of the Lord is really Jesus before he became Jesus. He was, Christ was existent in heaven with God from the beginning, and he was involved in the creation. Several places in the Bible say that. And so he didn't just go on vacation once the world began, and starting with Adam and Eve and all the way down through history till he entered the womb of Mary and was born as a human being. What was he doing in the interim times, thousands of years actually? Was he interested in what was going on? And the logical answer to that is yes, he was very interested in all of the things that happened before he became a human being. And we looked at the evidence, and that's listed in the handout today, that he was indeed what is called in the Old Testament the angel of the Lord, that was the pre-incarnate Christ. That means pre-incarnate means he was Christ before he became incarnated as a human being, put into the flesh. So he existed with God. He had an intense interest in the history of the Hebrews, Israel, and that was what we talked about last week. And I think that's the conclusion of this little review that I gave you at the end. It says, we consider that proved that that was indeed the case, that he is what is called the angel of the Lord. Now, in dealing with Abraham and Moses and the prophets, we'll find that it's the angel of the Lord, by and large, that we're dealing with when we talk about angels in the Old Testament. There are some other angels who show up, in particular in the book of Daniel, but they're not nearly as active as the angel of the Lord. That's a specific individual. That's the concept. And so when we're talking about angels and Abraham, we're really talking about the same individual who's spoken of as not only the angel of the Lord, but he's addressed as Lord, and in some places also as God. And that's true of Jesus and God, the Father, that they are one and are interchangeable in some senses of the word. Okay, any questions about any of that? Yes. Well, and the concept that Jesus tried to put across to his disciples, I and the Father are one, reinforces that kind of an idea. But they're separate personalities, obviously. They're separate persons. But they are somehow interchangeable. That seems sort of strange to us. God in three persons, the Trinity. Okay, Dan? As we are one. Yeah. Yeah. Separate individuals. Okay, Marcia, does that answer, is that what you wanted? Does that answer your question? Well, he's an angel in the sense that he's a messenger. But he's not an angel in the sense of the angels that were created at the time that mankind was created. He's got thousands and thousands of angels, and he uses other angels as messengers on occasion. I think maybe this particular messenger, this particular, the angel of the Lord, is intensely interested in what's going on and asks if he could have this assignment. I guess, I don't know, we're just guessing about that. But the thesis at the start of the class was that because God created the universe, he's not in the universe. He's not in what he created. He's bigger than the universe itself. And so he created something, and it's like the story that I told you about the computer class that creates a two-dimensional universe. They can't get into the plane of the 2D universe and interact with its creatures because they're three-dimensional. And then in the same sense, there may be some limitation that God has in entering our universe, but as if he enters it as Jesus, it is, Jesus is his messenger into our world. And Jesus can exist in three dimensions, and the angels can too. And so they're the way God interacts with humanity. And they are recognizable as something divine, something different from other people. But on occasion, they can sort of masquerade as a human being. Someone asked me this question last week. What about the case in Exodus where Moses asked to see God? And God says, you can't see my face and survive. You can only see my backside. Remember that? I'll put you in the cleft of a rock and cover you with my hand. Is that an exception to the rule? Did God actually come there? If it fits what we've been talking about, that's actually Jesus. That's actually the angel of the Lord that's interacting with Moses. But at that time, he doesn't want Moses to see him face to face. But he does later on after Moses proves himself. And that's kind of what we're going to talk about this morning about Abraham, too. After the golden calf incident and the way in which Moses reacted to that and how faithful he was in carrying out God's orders in destroying the wicked from among the children of Israel. Then he met with him face to face, and you remember what that involved. I mean, that left Moses with a glowing countenance and so on. God wasn't ready for that. Maybe that's all that means in the first case where you can't see me face to face. Yet, maybe that's the idea. I don't think that was God that the Israelites or that Moses saw. I think it was the angel of the Lord. But that's an opinion, okay? It fits the rest of the story, but you can hold a counter opinion. You can be wrong if you want to. I don't. I'm not trying to force something on you. But I want you to consider that as a possibility. Okay. Any other questions? These are hard concepts. Okay, they're not easy. If an angel appeared to you, how would you know whether it was just a generic angel or the angel of the Lord? You probably wouldn't know, would you? Do what? You pass out? Well, and actually, that's kind of funny because the two occasions where we know Daniel was approached by the angel of the Lord, and John was in the book of Revelation, and they did sort of pass out. It's overwhelming. But even an ordinary angel approach you, you might feel a bit woozy. I don't know exactly what the interaction is. And they, in both cases, both Daniel and in the case of John, it turns out to be Jesus. He leans, he touches and says, "Be strengthened, be strong." And lifts them to their feet, although they were so weak they could hardly stand. So it's an overwhelming experience to come into the presence of an angel. So, maybe for that reason, angels sometimes approach humanity as ordinary men. And we're going to talk about that at the end of the course. Do people see angels today? We'll save the punchlines there till the end of the course. But we see a case today in the case of Abraham where angels approach Abraham in the disguise, I suppose you'd say, of men, or maybe because of the clothing they were wearing and everything, it was impossible for Abraham to see any deviation from an ordinary person. They might have been taller or more handsome than normal. Any other questions about the angel of the Lord? Read this handout today. If you didn't get one, there's plenty of them, I think. So look at that, and it'll kind of review that for you, because we're going to, don't review it during class this morning, though. And we're going to see that most of the interactions with angels are really the angel of the Lord. Excuse me. Gail isn't here this morning. She was feeling kind of rocky this morning. She went back to bed, but she'll be here maybe for second service. We'll see. Okay, Abraham, the progenitor of the chosen people. He's the one, you recall, who was called from Ur of the Chaldea. God told him, I want you to go to a place where I'll lead you, and he went not knowing where he was going, and God led him eventually into Canaan after his father died, after Abraham's father went with him when they left Ur, and after he died. And then after Lot and Abraham separated when they got to Canaan, then God began to work with Abraham to prepare him for the ultimate task that was at hand. And basically what God was trying to do with Abraham was to begin a nation with a single family. And of course it didn't become a nation until they went to Egypt, and then at the time of the Exodus they emerged from Egypt as a great nation. So, there we go. Oops. Back up one. That's this one, isn't it? Okay. There we are. Now, there are two occasions we're going to look at this morning. The first one, the Lord appeared to Abraham near the great trees of Mamre. These must have been a special grove of trees that had been there maybe for thousands of years, sort of like sequoias or something. We don't know. They're not there anymore, I don't think. There may be trees at this region. It's close to the Jordan River and somewhat, well, about midway between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee on the western side of the Jordan River and in Canaan. And so he was sitting at the entrance to his tent in the heat of the day. And so that tells you it was probably in summertime, wasn't it? Abraham looked up and saw three men standing nearby. Do you suppose they just sort of appeared, or do you suppose they walked up? We're not told, do we? Are we? When he saw them, he hurried from the entrance of his tent to meet them and bowed low to the ground. He said, if I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, do not pass your servant by. And the word Lord there is not the same as the angel of the Lord, or the first sentence up there where the Lord appeared. That's Yahweh when it's written with capital letters. Here it just means, it's sort of like sir. If I found favor in your eyes, sir, do not pass your servant by. And incidentally, you know that's a song we used to sing, isn't it? Do not pass me by. Let a little water be brought, and then you may all wash your feet and rest under this tree, and let me get you something to eat so you can be refreshed, and then you can go on your way now that you've come to your servant. And very well, they answered, do as you say. This is typical Mideast hospitality. I think it is even practiced in this day and age, by the Bedouins at least. If you don't have an axe to grind and don't have a lot of enemies, this is the way you treat your visitors. And so you do this not even knowing who these people are. It's just common courtesy. Because, of course, people walked everywhere they went, and they were worn out after a leg of their journey, and they were dirty and hungry and tired, and so you could always find someone who would help you. And as a matter of fact, in the story later on down, where the angels go into Sodom, this is where God has in mind to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. When the angels go there, who is it that gives them that same courtesy? It's Lot, isn't it? Lot is has been well trained by his uncle Abraham, and he does the same sort of thing and takes these visitors into his home for the night. So that's the way it was supposed to be done, and we'll come back to this concept at the end of this particular story. So Abraham hurried into the tent. "Sarah, quick," he said, "get 3 seahs of fine flour and knead it and bake some bread." 3 seahs of fine flour is not a handful. It's quite a bit of flour. I don't know how much bread she was able to make from that, or if she made bread from all of 3 seahs of fine flour, but she's got to bake the bread. "Now he ran to the herd and selected a choice tender calf, gave it to the servant who hurried to prepare it. Then he brought some curds and milk and the calf that had been prepared and set these before them." How long do you think it took to make this dinner impossible? Do you ever watch that program on the Food Channel? Someone given an assignment to prepare a meal for 35 people in 30 minutes or something. Well, this is kind of what they're facing here, and it must have taken an hour or two to get all of this together and have it ready for the guests. And so he set it before them, and while they ate, he stood near them under a tree. And so these 3 individuals ate the food. You know, there are occasions where angels appear to people and will not eat their food. We saw that in the case of the visitor to Manoah. He said, I'll not eat any of your food. It isn't that they can't eat the food, apparently, because these visitors did. They may just choose to. And so while they ate, he stood near them under a tree. And so he's just being a gracious host. And then something that may have sent a chill down his spine. They ask him, "Where is your wife, Sarah?" How did they know his wife's name was Sarah? Did you ever have somebody ask you a question that you wondered, well, how did they know that? "They're in the tent," he said, but now he's got a clue that these aren't ordinary people. Then the Lord said, now notice, it's the Lord who's speaking to him, but he's on earth. And so this isn't God speaking. This is, I think, clearly the angel of the Lord. He said, "I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, will have a son." So this is someone who can predict the future. Someone who knows the promises that have been made to Abraham, because he had already been told that Ishmael wasn't to be the one, that he would have a son, he and Sarah would have a son between them that would be the one who would inherit and be the one through whom the promises would be fulfilled. So now he's probably, and we'll see later on, he's a person who takes all this information and reasons very quickly as to what it all means, and surely he knows now that he's talking to God. And very soon he will indeed address him just as that. This is not an ordinary man. This is a representative of the Father. Now Sarah was listening at the entrance to the tent, which was behind him, behind Abraham. Abraham and Sarah were already old and well advanced in years. You're being reminded of this by Moses as he writes this. And Sarah was past the age of childbearing. How old were they? Well, Abraham at this point was 99. And how old would you suppose Sarah is? She's 89 or 90. We don't know exactly, but 10 years younger than Abraham. And so Sarah laughed to herself as she thought, after I'm worn out and my master is old, will I now have this pleasure? She'd never had any children, and of course that was a great tragedy for women in those days. Then the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh and say, will I really have a child now that I'm old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? That particular question is one that you often have to ask yourself. And here's where it is in this story about Abraham. It's also said several other times in the Bible, but here's a key point. Is anything too hard for the Lord? Have you ever thought that something you would like to be done for you, but God can't do that, He won't do that? But nothing's too hard for God. I will return to you at the appointed time next year, and Sarah will have a son. He repeats that, doesn't he? In a very declarative way, reinforcing what he had said before. Sarah was afraid, so she lied and said, I did not laugh. But he said, yes, you did laugh. But that didn't negate the prophecy, did it? Her lack of faith in it a little bit at this point. She's going to find out that he was indeed telling the truth. Now, it's interesting that the word Isaac, which is the name that the son will have, what does Isaac translate as? Laughter. She'll be reminded every time they tell Isaac, don't do that, get away, sort of thing. Well, it's laughter. And she'll be reminded that she laughed because of his name. So when the men got up to leave, they looked down towards Sodom. And Abraham walked along with them to see them on their way. And then the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? What's he about to do? They're going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, aren't they? Well, shall I tell him what I'm going to do? Abraham will surely become a great and powerful nation, and all nations on earth will be blessed through him. For I have chosen him so that he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just, so that the Lord will bring about for Abraham what he has promised him. And what has he promised him? In our Thursday morning community Bible class, we've been talking about the three basic aspects of the promise given to Abraham. What was the first one? Make of thee a what? A great nation. And the second one was, I'll give you the land where you are dwelling to your posterity. And the third part of it was, and you and your seed, what? All nations of the earth will be blessed. Those are the promises that the Lord had given to Abraham. Back up to this verse, for I have chosen him so that he will direct his children. And Burton Kaufman makes an interesting argument here. He says that's mistranslated. For I have chosen him because he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord. That was important to God, that he knew that Abraham would do that. And that's why he was the beginning of a line that would lead to Israel, to the nation of Israel. He was chosen because he was faithful in his household and in teaching his children and to keep the way of the Lord. Then the Lord said, the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great that, and their sins so grievous that I will go down and see if what they have done is as bad as the outcry that has reached me, and if not, I will know. That sounds like he doesn't know, doesn't it? Does he know? He's already said, shall I tell Abraham what I plan to do? He knows the outcome of this, but he gives Abraham an introduction to a conversation that's coming along here. as though there's a possibility that Sodom and Gomorrah will not be destroyed. And why would Abraham be interested in that? Because what? Lot has moved to Sodom. And that's a serious problem. And once Abraham realizes what God is about here, he's quite worried about it. And so you know the story that follows this, but before we get to that, this verse in Hebrews 13, keep on loving each other's brothers. And we do in this congregation, brothers and sisters, love each other very much. It's very evident in all of the things that we do, and that's a hallmark of our existence here in the Woodlands. But do not forget to entertain strangers. See, that's the contrast here. For by so doing, some people have entertained angels without knowing it. And so who was the foremost in that as an example? He found out eventually that they were angels, but he may not have known it when they started, and of course that's Abraham. And so that's the verse that we normally think of back at the relationship between these two verses, the one in Hebrews 13 and the one in Genesis. Okay, so the story continues here in verse 22 of Genesis 18. The men turned away and went toward Sodom. But Abraham remained standing before the Lord. And so you see, it's got to be the angel of the Lord. So how many turned away and how many stayed? One stayed and two went to Sodom. And when you get into the next chapter, you see that the two angels, the story where they enter Sodom and talk to Lot. Then Abraham approached the angel of the Lord and said, see, he's worried here. Will you sweep away the righteous with the wicked? What if there are 50 righteous people in the city? Will you really sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous people in it? How many people do you suppose lived in Sodom? We aren't told. Do you picture that as just a little bump in the road with 50 people in it? Or are we talking about a city of 100 or 1,000 or 10,000? What's the picture you get here? When you look at the story of the angels talking with Lot and leading Lot and his family out of Sodom, get the picture of a pretty good-sized city. I would guess as an average of 1,000, perhaps. Cities weren't large. They were called cities. It would be a small village in our world, but in their world, it would be a city if it had 1,000 people. And if 50 of them were righteous, what percentage of that 1,000 would that be? So 50 out of 1,000 is 5 out of 100, which is 5%. In the Woodlands, how many people do we have? 80,000 is about where we are now, isn't it? How many people in the Woodlands are righteous? How many? We really don't know how many, do we? Who determines how many here are righteous? God knows how many are righteous. Suppose all of us in this congregation were righteous. How many are we talking about? 400. If 400 righteous souls live in the Woodlands, what percentage is that? Well, half of the people that live in the Woodlands are not yet mature people. They're kids, okay? Families have 2 or 3 kids. And so if you have maybe 40 or 50,000 adults who would qualify possibly as being righteous, and 400 are righteous, is that enough? And what percentage is that? Somebody doing the math for me here real quick? If it's 40,000 and 400, then 4,000 and 40 and 400 and 4, no, 400, yeah, 404 or 101, it's just 1%, isn't it? I think you can run that through your mental calculator. And we make up maybe 1% of the adults in the Woodlands. That's true. That's an interesting point. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, if we add in, if we're generous and add in, say, the Grace Crossing congregation and maybe some of the smaller central and some of the smaller congregations, maybe we can make up some of that. But we're talking about a small percentage. And you go on down, the Lord said, if 50 righteous people in the city of Sodom, I'll spare the whole place. What if only 10 can be found? Down in verse 32. Now Abraham goes through this long process of cutting the numbers down by 5 and 10 till he finally gets down to 10. What if only 10 righteous souls can be found? 10 out of 1,000 is what? It's 1%, isn't it? It's 1 out of 100. He answered, for the sake of 10, I will not destroy it. And when the Lord had finished speaking with Abraham, he left, and Abraham returned home. The rest of the story in the next chapter has to do with the rescue of Lot. We won't go into that this morning. But do you realize that your existence as a righteous person in a city maybe spares the city from God's wrath? And so being righteous is critical to the existence of a culture. And we live in a state and in a nation, and we worry, and our preacher this morning, Nathan, was telling us a little bit about our culture and the evils in our culture. God will sweep away an evil culture if he wants to. But the righteous souls in it, that's a prayer I use quite often privately, that I'll tell you that for the sake of the righteous in our nation, that God will continue to protect and bless it. I think that's important, that you realize how important your righteousness is to everybody else, even though they're unaware of it in our nation. Your righteousness is important to the integrity of our nation. Point? Yeah. Now, sometime later, and this is after Isaac is born, after he grows up, he's at least a teenager now, and maybe in his early 20s. Although the verse calls him a boy, that's how they felt about youngsters until they reached the age of 30. After all, these are men who are going to live to be 150 to 200 years old in the time of Abraham. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. Does God test people? And is that different from God tempting? Because God does not tempt, does he? Who does tempt? Satan. But God sometimes tests us. Pardon me? To see if they will do what I tell them to do in regard to the manna. Yeah. So he calls Abraham, and here I am, he replied. Then God said, and this would send a chill down his spine, take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about. So here Abraham is being sent again on a short journey this time to a place he doesn't know where it is. God's going to tell him as he goes. But he's on a task now that seems counterproductive. I mean, you're not supposed to sacrifice your own children. Why would God ask me to do that? So his mind is working. Keep that in mind. He's reasoning about this, and we'll see what conclusion he drew at the end of the story. Yes. He just said to him, we don't know. It says God tested him and said to him, and I presume this voice came out of heaven. I don't think he met an angel anywhere. He just woke up one morning, someone's calling his name, and you remember that happened to Samuel as a little boy. Someone calling, who is it? Well, he knew the voice. And it may have been the angel of the Lord. It may have been the voice he had heard before among the three men. We don't know. So early the next morning, Abraham got up and saddled his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. And when he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. And on the third day, Abraham looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship and then we will come back to you. So what's he's supposed to sacrifice that son as a burnt offering. The son's not coming back. But Abraham has concluded already that the son will come back, hasn't he? Whatever God has in mind, it's going to turn out all right because through Isaac, the great nation will come. There's got to be some answer to this puzzle, and he doesn't know exactly what it is. Now, this place, Moriah, where is that? It's interesting that it seems to be one of the hills upon which the city of Jerusalem was built. He's going to take him down to the region of Jerusalem and on a mountain there sacrifice his son the way God sacrificed his son as an offering to save mankind. So there's a parallel here that you'll watch and we'll review that at the end. So here they go. The son with the wood, Abraham on the left, leaving the donkey and the two servants behind, and headed again into the mountains. And so Abraham takes the fire and a knife, and his son is carrying the wood. God's son carried some wood up these same mountains. What wood was that? The cross. See the story that he's telling him here? Thousands of years before it actually happened, he knew God knew exactly how that story was going to play out. Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac. He himself carried the fire and the knife. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up and said to his father, Abraham, Father? Yes, my son, Abraham replied. The fire and the wood are here, Isaac said. But where's the lamb for the burnt offering? That tells you a couple of things. Abraham had not explained to Isaac what was about to happen, had he? And Isaac hadn't heard what God said to Abraham. So he was completely in the dark about what was about to happen. Abraham's answer is revealing. God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. Would God eventually provide the lamb for the sins of the world? Indeed so. And the two of them went on together. When they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. Isaac's a pretty good-sized guy. How is a 120-year-old man able to overcome his son and bind him and lay him on the altar? He taught his household well, and his son didn't resist him. That is amazing to me. I can't imagine any of our sons or my son or anybody else's son who wouldn't put up a struggle in a situation like this. But Isaac didn't, apparently. There he is on the altar, and Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. "Do not lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know." We'll come back to that phrase in a minute. "Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." Didn't God know before they went how it would turn out? He could have known. But remember, God could limit himself. If Abraham has free moral will in this event, he can make up his own mind. And God's not controlling the conclusion that Abraham is going to reach. And Abraham could have reached a different conclusion. But because he did what God said, "Now I know," God had sort of hidden from himself that result. But now he knows. He's not going to tell Abraham. He has to do it. If he chooses to do so, then he fears God. Abraham looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called that place, "The Lord will provide." And to this day it is said, "On the mountain of the Lord it will be provided." And of course that was in the time of Moses. But that is amazing, isn't it? That the Lord will provide the sacrifice. That's what Abraham had said in the beginning. The angel of the Lord called out to Abraham from heaven a second time. Now see, he's getting messages from heaven here through the angel of the Lord. The angel of the Lord's not appearing alongside of him. And he said, "I swear by myself, declares the Lord." And so this is God speaking, and it's the angel of the Lord speaking. This is one of those verses that pretty well solidifies the idea that the angel of the Lord, when he speaks, God is speaking. And Jesus, when he spoke on earth, was speaking for God, and he said, "I speak the very words of God." "Because you have done this and not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sands on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring all nations of the earth will be blessed because you have obeyed." There's this interesting verse in Hebrews. "By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promises was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, 'It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned.'" Abraham reasoned. Here's his mind working. That God could raise the dead. See, if he sacrificed Isaac, God would give him back to him alive. And figuratively speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. Very powerful, predictive event about the ultimate sacrifice of God's own son on Mount Moriah when he was crucified for the sins of the world. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week.